That's why whenever I talk about Israel, I always say re-establishing the state of Israel. Because if you say establishing the state of Israel, that implies that there was no state of Israel or no Jewish connection to the land prior to 1948. And I get a lot of people saying to me, oh, it didn't start on October 7th. I say, yeah, but it didn't start in 48 either. This started thousands of years ago when the Jews lived in Judea and were colonized and exiled by the Romans. This is when that starts. This all starts long before Islam existed, long before Palestinian was a word in anyone's vernacular. The way I always pose the concept of Jewish indigeneity to people, especially in Australia, is first off, I'll say, let's say, theoretically, when the English came and colonized what is now Australia back in the 19th century, they exiled all of the indigenous people, all of them, kicked all of them out, spread them throughout the world. They maintained their language, they maintained their culture and their traditions and their belief systems. All of these things were maintained. They maintained their own political systems, everything in their diaspora. And they came back this year in 2025 and said, this is our land. We were exiled from it. We are reclaiming our land. What would you say about that? And almost everyone will say to me, it is their land. They're indigenous. And I say, okay, let's say they were exiled for 500 years. Let's say they were exiled for 1,000 years. Let's say they were exiled for 2,000 years. When people say, what's your point? And I say, who are you to put this arbitrary timeline on when an indigenous group loses indigenous status?
What if you had to explain your entire identity, not to defend it, but to survive it? Hi, I'm Hannah, the host of Chapters. Today, Emily Samama joins me to share what it's like growing up as a proud Australian-Israeli Jew, navigating university after October 7th, having those prickly conversations, breaking down the words indigenous, ethnicity, and identity, not as slogans, but as truths. Not to ourselves, but also explaining it to the world around us. Through her learning, research, and lived experience, Emily brings the education and clarity that so much of us have been desperately searching for. This is one of the most eye-opening and educational conversations I've ever recorded. Enjoy. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Such an honor to have you today.
Such an honor to be on here.
Emily and I went to the same school together. We both went to Kestara, so we're both alumni. Shout out to that. And we both went to the same university. You're almost completing
yeah.
your Bachelor's of Science in Neuroscience at UNSW. And I also completed my degree at UNSW. However, I feel like our experience in universities were so different. And I think the way I went into university and the way you went into university was me like shutting out the outside world and saying like, I'm going in. I don't really care about like everyone in university. I'm just going to do my own little thing and sit in class, go home. And as much as I engaged with people at university, it was very like in the subject, let's take notes together and goodbye. And I remember and I recall seeing you in the beginning of your journey in university with a completely different approach, which I admired but couldn't understand because I guess for me, I'm always in my little bubble. I don't really feel the need, unfortunately or fortunately, just the way I see things. I, for some reason, don't feel the need to branch out. Like I didn't really want to make any new friends. I made a lot of Jewish friends, but like that was the beginning, middle and end. And you, which is so admirable, pushed yourself and like, I guess you can tell everyone yourself what that was like and why you went into university through that perspective. If you don't mind starting,
yeah.
just by telling us a little bit like how you grew up, what your parents, like they're Israeli if I'm
yeah.
right, you're mm-hmm. Israeli, you grew up in Sydney, a little bit about like your, I guess the way you defined yourself and your sense of identity and how that shifted or like why you chose to decide to be open when you entered university.
So my parents are both Israeli. My mom's half Sephardi, half Ashkenazi. My dad is Sephardi. And I very much grew up around like Sephardi culture and Jewish culture and Israeli culture. And I grew up speaking Hebrew. So I am fluent in Hebrew as well. I speak Hebrew, essentially only Hebrew to like my family.
Wow.
My parents are quite secular. Like my dad calls himself an atheist. He considers himself Jewish 100%, but he refers to himself as being an atheist in belief. And my mom is definitely more spiritual, but we were never very observant. Like, we kept Chagim. Like, we didn't fully observe the Chagim, but we do, like, Pesach, we'd do the Pesach Seder, and then, like, Rosh Hashanah, we'd do, like, dinner and everything. And I've always fasted Kippur, but that's kind of been about it, like, when it comes to observance. And, I mean, Kesher Torah is Chabad. So I did go to Chabad High School. It was a very interesting experience being from a secular background, because I found that I would have questions about things, and sometimes those questions would get shut down, and it sort of pushed me away from wanting to learn more, which I think is really
unfortunate. Is there an example of when you felt?
I remember, like, I must have been 16 and I was in Chumash, and I don't remember what the question itself was, but I had some question about what we were learning, and it was just shut down automatically, and I was kicked out of the class for the rest of the class. And I always thought that one of the, like, beautiful things about being Jewish is that we're constantly pushed to ask questions and to seek, like, proper, clear understanding of everything that we learn, and that we shouldn't be observing with blind faith. And mm-hmm. I always loved that about being Jewish, but then I kind of got shut down a few times over the years, and it pushed me back a bit. When it came to when I started university, I was the only person in my grade who went straight to uni. Everyone else went on a gap year. So I didn't know anyone at uni. And I thought, I have nothing to lose. I'm just going to try and meet random people. I almost wanted to distance myself a bit from the Jewish community, not from my identity of being Jewish, but I found that the Jewish community in Sydney is quite insular. Like, everyone kind of knows everyone. Everyone knows everyone's business, especially when you look at, like, the Israeli community and the Sephardi community. Like, you find that it's quite insular. And I just wanted to branch out. I'd only known Jewish people my whole life, and I wanted to meet people who weren't Jewish and see what that sort of, like, life experience was like. So I went to uni and I made a lot of non-Jewish friends. But it's funny. I think about it now, and being at uni, even though I didn't study politics or history or anything of the sort, I feel like being at uni and being around so many non-Jews almost forced me to learn more about my Jewish identity and more about my, like, about Israel and being Israeli, because people would always have questions for me. You know, I remember when I first met my closest uni friends, and all but one of them said to me, I've never met someone Jewish before. And I remember thinking, like, what do you mean you've never met someone Jewish? Because I'd only known Jewish people my whole life. So you get really comfortable and you get used to being around Jews all the time. And when people say, oh, I've never met someone Jewish, it's just, like, it just kind of takes you back a little bit.
So just for some context, so we went to UNSW, which is, like, a very, I would say, international university. It's not international university, but it is quite international.
It has a lot of my good friends were or are international students.
Like, what was the style? Where were they from? What was the, like, there's many different, like, I can say when I was at, it depends what subject you do. Like, when I was in the law school, everyone was, like, Aussie. But when I was in accounting, I was the only non-Mandarin speaking person in my class. So, like, who are your friends? Who do you gravitate to? What's the vibe in the science faculty?
Most of my friends did science education or engineering. And I found that, like, the backgrounds were quite varied. I had a lot of friends specifically for some reason from Bangladesh. Like, some of my closest friends are from Bangladesh, and a few friends from India. Where else? I'm trying to think. Korea, Vietnam, a little bit sort of from all across Asia for the most part.
It's really cool. It's cool.
And I have one good friend who's Egyptian, Coptic, and one who's South Sudanese. So also a bit of, like, African background. Very sort of varied, I found. Like, there were so many people doing the subjects that I was taking in my first year that, like, no matter where you went, there was a pretty, like, pretty big mix of different ethnic backgrounds and different languages and different religious backgrounds. Although the funny thing is, for the most part, I was the only Jew.
Wow. And it's amazing. I think unlike American universities where, like, everyone's American, we're really exposed to things. We're really exposed. Like, it's incredible. I remember I was doing this social change class. Like, it was like a gen ed, like a general subject. And we had to talk about, like, different problems, like world problems. And, like, one of the girls in my class, she was from Indonesia. and like the things that she was concerned about, like women's rights and like how she experienced the world when she was growing up, I was like, this is the fact that she even made it to Australia and like got into my class, and like I couldn't even understand. It was so different. It was so interesting, and we learned so much. And I remember her, and she was actually a really nice girl. But for me, it was like beginning, middle, and end. It was like goodbye. I just want to ask, like, in the beginning, did you feel comfortable? I have friends in uni that don't tell anyone they're Jewish. Did you feel comfortable telling everyone you're Jewish, Israeli, all of that?
So my sort of feelings about telling people that I'm Jewish have changed since October 7th, I think. I feel like that's kind of inevitable with the way the political landscape has kind of...
But before looked. October but before, 7th?
Yeah. I started in 2018. I had no issue telling people. Like, I remember the day I met all of my friends at uni. We sort of went around the circle because there were a lot of international students. We asked, where's everyone from? Like, what's everyone's background? So on and so forth. And I was the last one. And I said that I was Jewish and that my parents were born in Israel. And I remember the first thing that happened was one of the guys in the circle looks at me and goes, oh, you need to meet this girl because she's Palestinian and you guys are going to fight. That was literally the first thing I got when I said that I was Israeli, which I thought was really funny because we ended up being friends until October 7th, I think. I feel like a lot changed on that day. But I initially was quite comfortable with it. And I knew there was anti-Semitism because I'd witnessed it and eventually experienced it myself in those early years of uni.
Pre-7th of October, did you experience anti-Semitism? Yeah. Do you want to share?
I remember one time that Palestinian friend and I, there was a pro-Palestine rally on the library lawn outside the library, and she kind of wanted to go to stir up some shit. She wanted to, you know, kind of make fun of them a bit. So she said, let's go just for the fun of it, like not take it seriously. I said, sure, well, I have nothing to lose. So we go, and they ask her, are you Palestinian? She says, yes, blah, blah, blah. They ask her about it, whatever. They come to me and they ask me, are you Palestinian? I go, no, I'm Israeli, I'm Jewish. And the way that these girls, for the most part, changed, like their expressions changed as soon as I said I'm Jewish, I'm Israeli.
And where were these girls from?
There were some white girls. There was some, I think one girl was South Asian, like a bit of a mix, but a lot of them, not to my surprise, were white. But they all just looked at me differently. And one of them said, do you have family in Israel? I said, yeah, I do. She goes, well, they should go back to Poland where they're from. And I said, my family's not from Europe at all, let alone Poland. Very interesting that you pick the country that killed 90% of its Jewish population during the Holocaust to tell me to go back to. Like, I just thought that was really interesting. And I think a lot of the time people will, especially nowadays, will say to Jews, go back to Poland. And no one ever wonders, why does everyone say Poland? It is because that is the country that killed the most Jews during the Holocaust. It's not because the most Jews come from Poland.
So you're saying it's an overt anti-Semitic comment?
In my opinion, yes.
Interesting.
Another thing I find really interesting about it is if you told a black person, go back to Africa, that would be considered so racist, which it is. If you told a Vietnamese person, go back to China, that would be considered racist, which it is. But why is it not racist to tell Jews, go back to Poland?
It's also rude to tell a Vietnamese girl, go back to Vietnam.
Exactly. You know what I mean? Like, people are very casual with their anti-Semitism, and for some reason, they will not see the, like, blatant double standards in what they are saying compared to how a lot of other racists think. And I just found that a lot of people would quite casually say things that were pretty anti-Semitic to me, not think much of it at all. They just thought, like, they go, oh, Jews aren't a race, Jews are a religion. I said, no, Jews are an ethno-religion.
So it's, we're going to get into that, yeah, because I think you're brilliant and you actually have the knowledge that we all need. But you're saying pre-7th of October, the changes between pre and post, the anti-Semitic component, you weren't shocked. Like, you experienced it, you knew it was there. It wasn't believe we've been absolved of it for any capacity.
No, I mean, it definitely got a lot worse post-October 7th. I noticed on October 7th, it had already started getting worse. But it was always there. I've always noticed it. I've always witnessed it. I've experienced some of it on campus.
But it's amazing.
Absolutely nothing other than walking around with a mug and David. You know, people are very casual with anti-Semitism. It's seen as socially acceptable. I found, like, especially in recent years, and especially, like, because, you know, there's so much anti-Semitism on both sides of the political spectrum, I think that it's seen as not being an issue when it absolutely is.
It's amazing that you felt proud to walk around as a proud Jew, because Zalom Uvan Me'alav, like, it's not obvious, you know? I personally you saw me, I was very vocal. I'm very vocal. Like, I literally put up my hands in the first day of class, like, hi, I'm Hannah, because I'm Jewish. And, like, my name is Hannah, like, on the papers. Like, I didn't have to do that. Yeah. But I've been always very vocal and very proud of my Jewish identity. But there are girls that I know, like, that are pretty, like, observant and whatever, and they just didn't say anything. So it's not, it is like a big color covered, because it's not, it's, it is, listen, hanging out in the circles that you were hanging out, like, I remember seeing, like, your friends, and I remember being like, wow, I don't know how she's maneuvering this. Because it was, it's sad to say it's brave, but it is brave. Like, it's hard for me, just the way I feel about it. It's so hard for me to be, like, actual friends. Even today, I went to the laser appointment to get my hair removal, and the lady's like, oh, I want to go to Lebanon, I'm Lebanese. And immediately, like, I was so cautious of everything that came out of my mouth. And I was like, I don't know how I could ever be friends with anyone that I had to be so cautious with. So I think it's admirable that you were able to create actual real friendships, I'm assuming. Yeah actual, like, you went to their houses, like, proper friendships with people that I guess you didn't feel like you needed to tippy toe around them. Did you feel like that?
I mean, I think if I had met them post October 7th, I might have felt that way. But because I met them in 2018, for the most part, I didn't really feel that way. Like, a lot of my uni friends are Muslim, for example. A lot of them are pro-Palestine. And for a lot of them, I was their first exposure to Jewish people, and especially to Israelis. And I think that, like, I really liked being able to have that opportunity to be that for someone, like, to be someone's exposure to Israel and to Judaism and Jewish culture. And I don't know, I found it really interesting, because being that representation of Jewish people for so many people who had never met a Jew in their life, I felt the need to understand more and to learn more so that I could explain things a bit, like, more effectively when talking about it.
Were you not, did you know the answers, like, in the pre-October 7th?
I mean, I think I knew, like, I think I did a lot of my learning about Israel and about Jewish culture and heritage and all of that prior to October 7th. I'd say probably prior to COVID even.
Like, because you met these people? Yeah, wow. Yeah.
And I definitely did a lot more of that and sort of developed on what I'd already known post October 7th. I think that was a bit of a turning point for me as well.
So we were all, like, rummaging to, like, put in enough. Like, I remember after, like, the week after October 7th, I was doing so many, like, I teach Jewish history. So I was busy, like, teaching Jewish history, this and that, like, all these words, like, that we all had to, like, scramble to all of a sudden keep up. And everyone all of a sudden became, like, the biggest, like, everyone was just becoming learners of Israel and history, because you needed the answers. Like, you couldn't be a lazy Jew. You had to be actually proactive. But you had the answers. I would like you to tell us a little bit, walk us through your October 7th, and then consequently how that, what it was like. It was in October, so we were in university. What it was like going to university every day.
So I was in Israel on October 7th. Most of my family live in Israel, so we went to visit for the Chagim. And we were actually supposed to leave on October 8th. I was with my parents and my sister, and my dad and my sister, and I was staying with my Safta in Ramle. And
so, people that don't know, what is Ramle? And
Ramle,
what's the vibe?
Is next to Lod. So, like, next to the airport. It's sort of central Israel. It's about half an hour from Tel Aviv, I think. 40 minutes from Jerusalem. So it's pretty close to everything.
And the demographics.
And I know, it's quite a mixed town. I know there are a lot of Tunisian Jews. My family, my dad's side is Tunisian. And there is quite a big Arab-Israeli population as well. I think it's like 30% Arab-Israeli or 35%. So it's quite a significant portion of the population. Like, you drive around Ramle and there are a lot of mosques, a lot of, like, there's a lot of, like, you can tell it is a, like that it has a significant Muslim population.
Is it separated? Like, are there Muslim schools and Jewish schools? Do you know?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I'm not too sure on that.
Okay.
But I'm pretty sure it's relatively mixed because, you know, most places you go, you'll see women in hijab working there, and you'll see Jewish women working there, and you'll see Jewish men working there, and you kind of see a pretty, like varied mix of faces.
Okay.
But I remember it was October 7th. Like, we were supposed to leave the next morning. Our flight literally left the next morning from Ben Gurion. I remember I was asleep. All of a sudden, I was sleeping in the mamad. So all of a sudden, my safta and my dad and my sister come in. And, like, they run in and they slam the door. And I have no idea what's going on. I'm disorientated. I'm half asleep. It's 6:30 in the morning. And I ask them, what's going on? And my dad says, they're bombing us. And I'm like, who's them? And my dad goes, Hamas. Like, who do you think them is? You know, I thought maybe one, two rockets, whatever, that'll be it. We were in the mud for 11 hours. Our flight was cancelled. It was the craziest day, hearing all of, like, everything coming out in the news. And we had the news on all afternoon and evening. And I remember initially they said that there were, I think, 12 fatalities and 100 injuries. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, 12 people were killed. I mean, that was only, what, 1% of the actual number. Like, that was released later on. The first thing that happened is all of, like, not all of, but a lot of my friends back in Australia sent me a message being like, oh my God, I heard about what's happening in Israel. You were okay? I didn't realize it was such a big thing that it was, like, on international news. I had not realized the gravity of what was happening on that day. My flight gets canceled. I spend, like, my family go to Ben Gurion the next day. We spend 4 hours sitting on the floor of the airport trying to find a flight out. We kind of spent, like, 72 hours just flying around the world, which was kind of crazy, but it was also very expensive. But, you know, I was just, Baruch Hashem, we got out of there. Everyone was okay. You know, we didn't get hurt. But, you know, I did not realize how much would change post October 7th, especially in my relationships with the non-Jewish people in my life. Like, I think, you know, I think we all will remember October 7th for the rest of our lives. You know, like, you never, I feel like Jews feel about October 7th the way New Yorkers feel about 9/11.
For sure.
You know, my best friend is Jewish and a New Yorker. She lives in Manhattan. And she tells me all about, like, 9/11 and how it, like, she had family members who were affected and everything. And, you know, when I learn about 9/11, it's like, you know, I'm so far removed from it. But I think for the Jewish community, October 7th is that sort of day that we will memorialize forever, because it really changed everything for all of us. I think every Jewish person has had their life changed to some extent post October 7th.
I think arguably it's even stronger, because post 9/11, for example, I think, Kate, today I was at the gym and my gym instructor, she's quite secular, but she is just as Jewish as me. And everyone at my gym is 50 plus and all Jewish South African moms. Like, that's the vibe. It's an amazing gym, very aspirational. They all look very good. One lady who happened to know, the gym instructor was talking about Noah Tishbe and Israel and the hostages and whatever. And one lady who I know, she's like South African, and she's like, Khana, she shouldn't be speaking so loudly. Like, there are non-Jews in the class. And I was like, I don't think that's a problem. Like, I wanted to say more, but I didn't want to be disrespectful. But my point was, like, post 9/11, everyone knew that Al-Qaeda was horrible. Like,
yeah,
it wasn't disputable.
They didn't blame the US for 9/11.
Yeah, no
one
didn't
blame the victims of 9/11 for 9/11.
Yeah, it was very, like, right now this week that Hamas is literally, like, terrorizing Gazans, and it's like, I hope people are watching this, and it's the most, they're literally assassinating them on the street. It's like the most horrendous footage, and it's like, we've been telling you they're terrorists all along, but no one seems to care.
I make a concerted effort to expose myself to pro-Palestine and anti-Israel, you know, people on social media. I've seen people saying death to the collaborators, celebrating the murders.
That is insane.
Saying death to the collaborators, death to the Zionist entity. Like, the craziest stuff.
No, the hatred is so blinding.
Oh, it's insane. It's, wow, absolutely insane.
And 9/11, let's say, it wasn't confusing. It wouldn't be, it wouldn't, we wouldn't have to whisper. Like, I think it's not a problem because if I'm so firmly believing that Hamas is Al-Qaeda, I can scream at the top of my lungs that about the hostages and about Israel because we know we're on the right side of history. Yeah. She's obviously feeling insecure and that's her problem. But I was like, that's not a problem. And I think 9/11 had that effect that people were saying, which was everyone knew who what was bright and what now all these years later they have all these theories and whatever, but we had to experience being victims and being like treat like the worst thing that happened to Jews since the Holocaust, like hostages, murder, rape, like most horrible things, but at the on the same foot on the same day had to stand up and defend ourselves for the fact that we were victims. Like 9/11, maybe 25 years later, people are saying, oh, all the conspiracy theories are coming out, but not on that exact day. On that exact day, it was clear to the world. And in some ways, I think 7th of October, like, was psychologically, spiritually, physically traumatic on every single level.
Oh, absolutely.
And I would argue, in a way, worse, because the world at that day, on that day in America, the world thought felt bad for America. On the day of the 7th of October, I remember Kylie Jenner posting and deleting. And it was such a moment for me. I was like, she's posting on the 7th of October, getting so much hate. And on the day that we are being murdered, it's controversial.
It's like Jews aren't allowed to be victims. And you know what I, the first thing I think about, like the first response to October 7th that I think about, that I remember, was my, one of, I had two good Palestinian friends. One of them posted glory to the resistance, you know, glory to the martyrs, blah, blah, blah. I blocked her straight away. I was like, nope, we're not doing this.
And you were good friends with her.
Oh, we'd been close for at that point, 5 years, five and a half.
Like you went to her house?
Yeah, we went out very often. Like, we'd been quite good friends.
Can't believe
and
that.
The second thing I think of was when I was sitting, I was like half asleep in the middle of Mumbai airport. And this was when there were those chants at the Opera House. Gas the Jews, death to the Jews. Or where, they said, where's the Jews? To be honest, yeah, I don't believe
and
that.
And where's the Jews? Where are you going to find them?
First off, if you're asking where's the Jews, you're trying to hunt down the Jews. I think it's pretty obvious.
That was hilarious. Yeah. That police report, I watched it. It was comedy. I was laughing. So according to our investigations, they weren't saying gas the Jews, F the Jews. They were saying where the Jews. I'm like, so you're trying to find them? Where are they?
Why else would they want to know where the Jews are?
So it was embarrassing for the police department. I was embarrassed for them.
Honestly, a lot of the police department, like the Australian like police forces' responses to the anti-Semitism that's been going on in this country.
It's embarrassing.
Absolutely. Like, shameful. Genuinely.
Okay, so where were we? Oh, October 7th. So you're in the airport. You have some friends reaching out to you. What do they say? Hope you're okay.
Like, hope you're okay. Hope your family's okay. What happened in Israel is awful. Like, I'm so sorry to hear about it. Like, that sort of thing. It was a pretty generic, like, response to what happened. But you know what? I appreciated it. I think most people
will take
did
what
not
we can
and
get.
Still don't understand all of the complexities of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
No.
I had people who literally would come, like, I had one friend who didn't talk to me for a month and a half post-October 7th. And then she came to me and she sent me this essay and said, all of your education is biased. You don't know anything. I understand this. I've been learning about it for the past month and a half.
Was she Muslim?
No, she was white.
She's busy educating herself on TikTok propaganda.
Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is a legit source, apparently. Oh, everyone who knows me knows how I feel about Al Jazeera.
Tell us what Qatari.
Qatari state-funded media, but also Al Jazeera English and Al Jazeera Arabic say two completely different narratives. There are two completely different narratives depending on the language because they know that the majority of the people being exposed to Al Jazeera English are like your standard Western white people. And the majority of people being exposed to Al Jazeera Arabic are Arabic speakers who, some of which are radicalized, you know, who have been exposed to anti-Israel propaganda their whole lives. And are sort of desensitized to it. So you get two completely different narratives depending on what language you're looking at. Which, in my opinion at least, shows that there is a lot of bias and inconsistency in the reporting, that it's not a proper legitimate source. But
I feel like people don't care. You know? Like, people hear what they want to hear. People see what they want to see. But it's insane. It's too... The world has never been so confusing. It's like I listen to my mom listening to the news and it's like a completely different news to like the outside world.
Oh,
it's like how it's so – I don't even blame people. Like this laser lady today, the Lebanese girl, her name's Miriam. She was very nice. She's like, it's all over. The war's over. I'm like – yes, darling. Like, she has no idea what's going on. Like, that's zero. She's like, I saw on TikTok terrible videos of the children. I'm like, yeah. I was like, yeah, I was in Tel Aviv during the war. Like, I was in Israel during the war. She's like, oh, it was terrible, the children. Like, she has no idea what she's talking about.
It's like, what I've noticed is a lot of people seem to think that this... You get a lot of people who say, this didn't start on October 7th, but also acting like it started on October 7th. You know what I mean? Like,
no,
people
explain.
Who had absolutely no awareness or education regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict until October 7th. And all of a sudden, they're geopolitical experts.
So I'm obviously an educator, and I believe, and I'm super passionate about education. And I think our big problem is that we are not allowed to be apathetic Jews. We cannot be apathetic. It's just impossible. We cannot be people that walk around this planet and have no idea who we are, where we come from, and don't have answers, because unlike any other racial group or any other ethnicity, as we're going to discuss, we are forced to explain our existence and explain our who we are.
So justify it.
Yeah, we have to like explain why we deserve to exist.
Yeah.
Unlike any other, like no black man has to stand and defend his right to be black. And yet, because we, I don't know why our colors are the way they are and why God made us, like, it's so hard to explain what it means to be a Jew. And I think because for me, the reason why I'm here, like, I'm asking for your help over here is because for me, being Jewish has always been something spiritual. It's very hard. I don't know the words, the right words to explain what it means to be a Jew. But through your incredible journey of having to, I guess, explain who you are to people that will not understand. Like for me, it's very easy for me to stand up in front of Jews and be like, Chelek Elokai Mimal Mamash, we have a piece of God inside of us and we're spiritual. Like that's not going to help. Like this, your random friend from Pakistan doesn't understand Chelek Elokai Mimal Mamash. And that's my vernacular. Like I teach, that's what I teach. And that's the way I feel. Like I feel like you feel Judaism, like it's something inside of you. However, you're here to tell us how we can practically explain it to the world, even though it's sad that we need to explain it, but yet for some reason it's so critical. The first thing I want to talk about is being indigenous. That is the strongest argument for Jewish people living in Israel, because like we said, for thousands of years, we didn't necessarily live in Israel. We were in diaspora, but to explain that we are indigenous, we have this connection to the land. How you would explain what it means to be indigenous and how Jewish people are indigenous to the land of Israel.
Okay. The way I see it is there isn't one universally regarded definition of indigeneity, but there are some criteria that are most often looked at when it comes to determining whether a group have indigenous status. Those would be self-identification as an indigenous group, historical continuity with pre-colonial societies, strong link to land or territories, non-dominance, so political and social marginalization, and then existence of distinct social, cultural, linguistic, political, and agricultural systems.
Okay, so you need to explain that to me.
Okay, so the first one being self-identification. I think when it comes to talk of whether a group is indigenous, I think historically it hasn't been something that's been commonly discussed. I think it's a very modern concept, like talking about indigeneity and what groups are regarded as indigenous. But I think by modern standards, most Jews do self-identify as being indigenous. I think for the most part, if you find someone who is educated on Judaism and Jewish culture and heritage and Israel, for the most part, we will self-identify as being Indigenous. Then when it comes to historical continuity with pre-colonial societies, it is talking essentially the societies that existed within the land prior to colonization by the Romans. And those were Jewish societies.
So you think that because we live in an age where the idea of indigeneity, the focus on it is fairly new?
I would say yes.
And that makes sense because I think for majority of history, it was the conqueror. The conqueror
exactly.
was the one that, like, no, even if we think about Australian history, if we think about the 60s, the Aborigines, Indigenous people of Australia were a footnote. Like, no one cared because the British came and overtook it and colonized it. And, like, for majority of history, colonization was celebrated. Like, the king, if you came and over, like the Romans and the Greeks and everything we learn about in school, like the Persian Empire, if you expand your empire, you're the strongest and you have the biggest muscles. But that narrative has definitely shifted.
Oh, 100%.
100%. So if we think about it, like, fair and square, we have fought for the land and, like, Six-Day War. Like, we are the ones with the stronger muscles, if you think about it. Like, we have a stronger army. But that doesn't work. Like, I used to be like, well, fair and square, the Six-Day War, like all these wars where we actually stood up, we were able to fight against our enemies. Therefore, we have a legitimate connection to the land. But firstly, it's not a narrative that works in today's society, one. And two, that's not it. We're not there. We try and explain something deeper, that we're Indigenous to
the
land.
That's the thing. When I try and explain it to people, we're not there because the Jews needed a piece of land. We're there because the Jewish people had a piece of land. It was taken from us and we've reclaimed it. That's why whenever I talk about Israel, I always say re-establishing the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you say establishing the state of Israel, that implies that there was no state of Israel or no Jewish connection to the land prior to 1948. And I get a lot of people saying to me, oh, it didn't start on October 7th. I say, yeah, but it didn't start in 48 either.
Yes.
This started thousands of years ago when the Jews lived in Judea and were colonized and exiled by the Romans. This is when that starts. This all starts long before Islam existed, long before Palestinian was a word in anyone's vernacular.
Yes. That's why I said that I'm not really Zionistic, because Zionism, obviously I'm Zionistic in the fact that I love Israel and blah, 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 and the IDF and all that, Tzvagan al Israel, yay, yay, Israeli flags. But I do think there is danger in, like, Yom HaAtzmaut, the way we talk about it. Like, Israel is not 76 years old. Zionism was an ideology. It's not the reason why we live in Israel. And I think the world is screaming that to us. I think the world is trying to tell us something. For me, the reason why the world is screaming at us, Zionazis, blah, 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 why they're calling us Zionazis is because they are telling us in their own convoluted way without realizing that the word Zionism is not our strongest bet. It's not working. Like, I don't think
I agree.
Screaming at the world and telling them, I am a Zionist, we are Zionists, doesn't make sense, because Zionism was a response to anti-Semitism. Theodor Herzl was not screaming about indigeneity. He was speaking about, he was at the Alfred Dreyfus case. He was a highly secular Jew living in Budapest, highly all of a sudden aware of how bad anti-Semitism is, realizing that Dreyfus was being convicted because he was a Jew, and said, we need a solution. And the solution is going to be Zionism, which is great. And then it happened through miracles, okay? Through miracles. We came back to this land in 1948. But that is not the reason why we live in Israel. That was just, like you said, re-establishment. We are coming back to the country. So I'm not so keen on the Zionist narrative, because I don't think the Zionist narrative tells the whole story.
Absolutely.
And
I'm with you on that 100%.
And like you were saying, there's a lot of states
younger than Israel.
Yeah. So when the reason why I say this doesn't work for our narrative is because people come and tell us, oh, 1948, well, my grandfather's older than your country. And then I tell them, no, 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 you're not older than Avraham Avinu. You're not older than my indigenous connection to this land.
It's like, if you would, like, the way I always pose the concept of Jewish indigeneity to people, especially in Australia, is first off, I'll say, let's say, theoretically, when the English came and colonized what is now Australia back in the 19th century, they exiled all of the Indigenous people, all of them, kicked all of them out, spread them throughout the world. They maintained their language, they maintained their culture and their traditions and their belief systems. All of these things were maintained. They maintained their own political systems, everything in their diaspora. And they came back this year in 2025 and said, this is our land. We were exiled from it. We are reclaiming our land. What would you say about that? And almost everyone will say to me, it is their land. They're Indigenous. And I say, okay, let's say they were exiled for 500 years. Let's say they were exiled for 1,000 years. Let's say they were exiled for 2,000 years. When people say, what's your point? And I say, who are you to put this arbitrary timeline on when an Indigenous group loses Indigenous status?
Wow.
You know, when we look at Indigenous people in Australia, we, because they managed to stay here, we see them as having that connection to the land, but people don't realize that an Indigenous group can have a connection to their land without living in it. Oftentimes because of exile, because of living in a diaspora. And it's funny when people use the word diaspora in reference to Palestinians.
Because
the word, I've heard people say Palestinian diaspora. It's so funny to me because the word diaspora was coined in reference to the Jews outside of Israel.
100%.
The term was specifically invented in reference to us. So it just, the irony of people using the term Palestinian diaspora is not lost on me, you know? But when it comes to this discussion of indigeneity, people say to me, oh, Indigenous status expires after X amount of years, after Y. Why are you the one who gets to make that decision? Why are you the one who gets to determine when Indigenous status expires? And when it comes to Indigenous status and Indigenous self-identification for a group, like, you can't be Indigenous if you lose all of your connection to your original Indigenous culture. When you look at Jews, you know, when it comes to like criteria on indigeneity, social, cultural, political, linguistic, and agricultural systems that are connected to that piece of land and that group of people, we have all of those things. We have Batei Din, right? We have our own political system. We have our own culture. We have our own language. We've been speaking Hebrew for 4,000 years. And yes, we had to revive the language. But why do you think we had to revive the language? Why do you think Jews were put in a position where we weren't able to speak Hebrew on a day-to-day basis? Because we were exiled. We lived in the diaspora. We were forced to speak other languages. We didn't have a choice in that. So Jews reclaiming Hebrew and modernizing Hebrew as a language is a way that Jews reclaimed that Indigenous identity. And like, I know a lot of people don't see it that way necessarily, but that's kind of what it is if you think about it. And when it comes to, this is where it gets interesting because people say, well, but Palestinians are Indigenous. No, they're not. And people get angry at me when I say that. And I'm like, look, I'm not saying that we should kick all the Palestinians out of Israel. I'm not saying that. But when it comes to Indigenous status and Indigenous identity, Arabs are not Indigenous to the Levant. So Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, Palestinian territories. Arabs are not Indigenous to this region. Arabs are Indigenous to the Arabian Peninsula, you know, Iraq, Yemen, Oman, Qatar, Bahrain, etc. That part, Saudi Arabia. And Arabic is not Indigenous to the Levant. It's not an Indigenous language of the Levant. Islam is not an Indigenous religion of the Levant. It was not created and founded in the Levant. And people say, but oh, Palestinians genetically, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't matter. When it comes to who gets to identify as being an Indigenous group, if you have lost all of your Indigenous culture, language, and heritage because you've been Arabized, you're no longer Indigenous by definition.
Wow.
So I think it's a huge misconception that, oh, because they are the natives, because they were the ones living there, they are the Indigenous group. Arabs only made it to the Levant in the 7th century through imperialism and colonization. It's like, I notice when a lot of people, especially, I think this is something I see a lot because I am more left-wing, but when I see people on the left talking about, you know, colonization and colonialism and imperialism, I think, they seem to have this idea that only Europeans and white people are able to be colonizers and imperialists, which is so ironic because the spreading of Islam throughout the world was peak Islamic imperialism and colonialism. It's just almost ironic to me when people will say Palestinians are the indigenous people of this land. Okay, then where's Arabic from? Where is Islam from? Where does their culture come from? Where do all of these things come from? Where do they originate from? Because you can't tell me it's in Israel. On the other hand, where does Judaism originate from? Where does Hebrew originate from? And like the only, I think when it comes to like the idea of who is indigenous in this day, there are two groups, the Jews and the Samaritans. Samaritans are also indigenous to the land, but other than them, it's just us.
So the Samaritans lived in Israel?
In Samaria.
In Samaria. What point in history? Like when we lived there?
I don't know too much about Samaritan history, but I believe it was around the time we were there, but they have a continued presence there. So they've been there for the most part for a few thousand years. They are a pretty small population though. Then there aren't many of them, to be fair.
Okay, so I want to go through also the agricultural. You were saying what is indigenous? Like, so we have the Chagim.
Yes. Like Sukkot, for example, we have a lot of like land-based agricultural practices that specifically tie to the land of Israel. That is a sign of indigeneity. The fact that like, you know, like Shemitah year, all of that, every 7 years you let the land rest, that is an inherently indigenous concept.
Wow.
Because specifically pertains to the land in Israel. It's not saying, like, it's not like we apply Shemitah to everywhere. Mm-hmm. It is a specific law that specifically is only applied to Israel.
It's like Chag HaAsif, Chag HaKatziv. Yeah. Like, all our Jewish holidays are the cycle. So we've been keeping that all these generations. And that implies our indigenous connection to the land. That's
absolutely,
one of the
100%.
One of the criteria. Okay, what are the other criterias? Political, linguistic, so, cultural, social.
Non-dominant, so political and social marginalization. We know all too well about that, about being marginalized societally. Jews have been a marginalized group for thousands of years. We've been persecuted for thousands of years. I've seen many anti-Semites throw around the number 109 because that is apparently the number of countries that Jews were kicked out of.
Saying that what? What is that? Why does that prove their point?
No, it's essentially saying, oh, 109 countries kicked you out. Therefore, we have a reason to hate you. Everyone has a reason to hate you because why were you kicked out of so many countries? But
interesting.
The thing about that is, we have been marginalized for thousands of years. Ever since we were exiled from our land and spread out into the diaspora, we have been a marginalized group. Mm-hmm. We have experienced ethnic cleansing and genocide and pogroms almost everywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that almost speaks to the fact that we are an indigenous population.
But why do you have to be that I'm asking a question on the definition, but like, why do you need to be? Why is that an inherent, like, why do you have to be persecuted to be indigenous?
It's not inherent, and you don't necessarily need to be persecuted to be indigenous. It's just something that tends to be a commonality within indigenous groups. Like if you compare Jews, for example, to indigenous Australians, indigenous Americans, most indigenous groups have been persecuted by the overarching force to some extent. That is just something, it's not something that has to occur, but it's just something that tends to be a commonality.
What bothers me is that I feel like we are trying to explain ourselves based on what is cool to explain yourself as. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
I don't want that. Like, I know, whatever, it is what it is. And like, that's what we need to do. But like, let's say we lived in colonial times. All of a sudden we'll be like, oh yeah, we're the strongest. So everyone needs to love us. Now we have to be like, oh, we're victims.
That's the thing. When you look at Zionism back in, you know, the late 19th century, early 20th century, it was described in such a way because that was how that was seen as, that was sort of the prevailing narrative about people living in a certain piece of land. It was more about colonialism than it was about Indigenous rights. That narrative has just shifted in recent years to people caring more about Indigenous rights than they do about colonial rights, if that makes sense. And yeah, it is, for the most part, it is sort of, you know, something that we like, that depends on like cultural context. But at the same time, Jews are actually an Indigenous population. If you look at most definitions of the term Indigenous, Jews do meet that.
No, we're definitely Indigenous. Yeah. But I think we have such a unique experience that 100%. No definition is going to be able to explain our story. Our story is so unique. Like an Indigenous people coming back to their land after 2,000 years, coming from Eastern Europe, looking white, even though everyone in Israel is not white. Like that narrative is so, only we experience it. So I feel like we're having trouble explaining it because it's hard to explain.
The thing that about looking white that's very funny to me is I've noticed there are lots of non-white groups that look white. But the only
group
that is...
There's so many Arabs that look very white that I meet in Tel Aviv. I have a friend that I met at the beach in Israel, and I would never think he's Arab. He is gingy.
But that's the thing. There are so many different ethnic and racial groups where people look white, but they aren't. And the only group that's ever questioned is Jews.
What are other ones?
Like, mainly Arabs. A lot of Arab populations are seen as white. A lot of North Indians, for example, look white. I have a friend who's North Indian. She's very pale, and everyone said that we look like twins, put it that way. There are quite a few ethnic and racial groups out there that look white but aren't. I think when it comes to like racial and ethnic identity for Jews, I think it's a bit, you know, it's a bit convoluted, but people say, oh, what, are Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jews and Mizrahi Jews and Ethiopian Jews all the same ethnicity? Yeah, they are. Those are sub-ethnic groups. But also, another thing that ties us all together is genetics. If you get a genetic test done as a Jew, it will show on that genetic test that you are a Jew. Like, if you get a random European man from Poland and a Polish Jew to do a DNA test, you'll be able to tell which one is which. That is something that can only be done when you have carried something through your genetics for thousands of years.
Wow.
When it comes to, like, even when people say, oh, Ashkenazi Jews are European, they're not. They're not European Jews. Ashkenazi Jews are Ashkenazi Jews in the sense that it's not that they are Jews from Europe. They are Jews from the Levant who found themselves in Europe in the diaspora. And another thing that shows that Jews are an Indigenous group is the fact that we still have genetic ties to the Levant from thousands of years ago. If you get a DNA test done as a Jew, it almost certainly will show that you are Jewish. I've had one done. My DNA is mostly Sephardi North African. I think I was like 17% Ashkenazi Jewish, and it came up as Ashkenazi Jewish. It didn't come up as European. Because there's a difference between them. That's the thing. You can differentiate. If you can differentiate between Ashkenazi DNA and European DNA on a test, that evidently shows that there is something to be differentiated between.
Wow. I love that. No, it's true. I have a theory, but this has not been proven. So I'll just, if this is not, just take this with a grain of salt. But I think all Ashkenazi Jews were originally, most of Ashkenazi Jews were Sephardic Jews. Because if you follow like the trail of after 1492, like when the Jews were expelled, a lot of Jews did start going to Amsterdam, Belgium. Like that was like they started to go more west. And then when the Polish king started inviting the Jews, they started migrating East Europe. So I think even though I'm Lithuanian from my dad's side and from my mom's side, I'm Persian, I think I'm not Sephardi, I'm not Spanish from my mom's side because my mom's side has been living in Iran since the time of the Purim story. I think from my dad's side, I could have Sephardic roots because they did migrate from Spain. Spain is in Europe. People forget that. So that's my theory. I don't know if that's true. That's my little speculations from my little brain, but I do think, the concept of being Eastern European doesn't make sense. And also it's funny because like back to like the context of having to explain ourselves based on the times that we're in, that's what's so confusing. Like think about during the Holocaust, like they were so busy trying to prove that Nuremberg race laws in 1936, they were so busy trying to prove that we were like aliens and had different blood. Like, and we had to sit and prove that we were just not like that. And now have to sit and prove, like we're always having to prove who we are. It's so frustrating.
Yeah. And it's even anti-Semitism has shifted over, you know, contextually, because, you know, anti-Semitism in the time of the Holocaust was quite race-based. It was Jews are an inferior race. Jews are not white Europeans. There were times prior to the Holocaust where anti-Semitism was about Jewish belief and the fact that we did not believe in Jesus. And nowadays, anti-Semitism is about our homeland.
Yeah, it's so true.
Anti-Semitism has shifted to fit whatever is prevailing contextually, whether that be Zionism in the homeland or like the basis of Jews being an ethnic group or a race, or if that's just Jewish belief and Jewish religion.
I think about it like with Avraham, like the first Jew was they try to kill him because of his monotheistic beliefs. And then we have like the first time that Jews were discriminated based on their race was in 1449 in Toledo, when because all the Jews during the Spanish expulsion, before the Spanish, like the Spanish Inquisition was basically targeting Jews that were forced converted in 1391 pogroms. So there were converso Jews and regular Jews. Like people get confused. In 1492, the people that were expelled were the Jews with the tzitzit openly being Jewish. The Jews that were forced converted still stayed in Spain, right? They were forced converted 100 years earlier, but they stayed in Spain. But in 1449, there were protests on the street of Toledo basically saying, why should these Jews that are Christian, new Christians, why should they have the same rights as us? Their blood is different. And that was the first time that it wasn't based on your belief, because technically they were Christian, they were baptized, but they were having the same rights as other Christians, and other Christians had a problem with it. They said, well, they were forced converted in 1391. So it's children and grandchildren, right? These people are, it's father and sons, I'm assuming. So, but they, is it clear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So like in 1449, they were saying, why should they have the same rights as me? Their blood is different. And that was the first time that Jews, it wasn't about what belief you had that you were discriminated against. Like if you were believing in Jewish or believing in Christianity, it wasn't enough to convert, because the Christians try to convert us and then we were the same. But in Toledo in 1449, they were saying, it doesn't matter if you convert, you're still different. You're still Jew. You're still blood. Like this is a racial discrimination. And that carried through into the Holocaust, where it was like, it didn't matter if your grandfather was Jewish on your father's side. You have Jewish blood.
Yeah, during the Holocaust, they considered one quarter Jewish blood to be Jewish.
And that's
you could have been racial. Practicing Christianity. You could have been atheist. Didn't matter.
No.
The Nazis didn't care because they said, you're Jewish blood, you are a Jew. Your belief system doesn't matter.
But that doesn't carry on to this narrative, doesn't fit their narrative. Like the anti-Semitism today.
Anti-Semitism today wants to detach Jewish identity from being an ethnic group, because that sort of takes away from a lot of the narratives of there were Palestinian Jews, Christians and Muslims. No, there weren't. Jews were never considered Palestinian. We were a separate ethnic group with separate cultural linguistic ties prior to the foundation of Israel. When the term Palestinian was used, it was most often pertaining to Jews. Arab was used for what is now considered Palestinian. Only in the 60s did Palestinian become an Arab identity. Palestinian meant Jewish all throughout like 1900 to 1948 prior. Like, I remember seeing Bella Hadid. She shared a video on her Instagram story of the Palestine men's soccer team. The team was Maccabi Tel Aviv and all of the players were Jewish. This was obviously prior to the foundation of Israel, like the reestablishment of Israel. But she shared this video as though this is evidence that there was a Palestine men's soccer team. It was Palestinian. No, it wasn't. It was Jewish. It literally just says Palestinian because Jews were the identity that most often referred to themselves as Palestinian in the times of the British Mandate. In the times of the British Mandate, Arabs considered themselves Arab. They didn't consider themselves Palestinian. Identifying with the modern-day Palestinian flag only started in 1967 or 1964, I can't remember which year, but in the 1960s. This shift in how people identify is a pretty new thing. It's not something, and when they remove Jews from their ethnic identity, they can say, oh, there were Palestinian Jews and Palestinian Christians and Palestinian Muslims. No, there weren't. That's not how society was at the time. That was, and that isn't how Palestinian society is today. How many Jews live in Gaza? Zero. How many Jews live in the West Bank? Only the settlers. Palestinian, modern day, they want to say it as though Palestinian society is accepting of Jews. But modern day Palestinian society proves to us themselves that they are not accepting of Jews. Why do you think that until last week, the only Jews in Gaza were the hostages? Why is it that the hostages were the only Jews in Gaza if Palestinian society, there were Palestinian Jews? And when they make it all about religion, they say, oh, it's like they want, the reason why they wanted to detach Jews from their ethnic identity is because they want to say, oh, this is all about religion. Jews live in Israel. They think Israel is theirs because it was promised to them 3,000 years ago. And that's just a massive misconception. And I think people feed into that misconception because it aids their narrative. I think when it comes to, like, it obviously supports the modern day Palestinian narrative to say Jews don't have a connection. It's just because their Torah promises this land 3,000 years ago. That's what happens when they detach Jews from being Jews and they make it Judaism the religion.
I don't understand. But we do say that God promised us 3,000 years ago. Yeah, why is
we
that?
We do.
Yes.
We do. But the thing is, you can't really argue with non-Jews that God promised us the land 3,000 years ago.
Okay.
Because 99.8% of the population doesn't believe in our religion, doesn't believe in our Torah.
Yes.
But when you can prove that Jews have long-standing connection to this land other than based on religion, there's more evidence as to why we belong there.
Mm-hmm. There's also much archaeological evidence.
Oh, yeah. Don't even start me on the archaeological evidence. But you can throw a rock in the land of Israel and find evidence that Jews have been there since time immemorial. You can throw, literally, there is a plethora of evidence that proves that Jews belong in that land.
What I really wanted to ask you is to explain ethnicity.
All right, so an ethnic group specifically pertains to a group of people that maintain similar cultural, linguistic, and societal systems, if that makes sense. So it's not racial in the sense of you can visibly see it. It's not like you can be like, let's say you can be Ashkenazi and be Jewish, and you can be Ethiopian and be Jewish. Those two people, obviously not the same race, but they have the same ethnic background because they have the same religion, the same like culture, the same language. All of these things go back thousands of years. So when we're talking about ethnicity, it is sort of akin to race in the sense that it is, I mean, it's hard to sort of explain, but when it comes to race, it's a bit more phenotypical. Race is more so what do you look like.
Phenotypical mean, or the way you look at it?
Yeah, okay. Like what sort of features present. But ethnicity is more so about the like cultural and linguistic ties that someone would have and like tradition and all of that. So when it comes to like if you're talking about an ethnic group, if you're saying Jews, for example, we all speak Hebrew. We're from the Middle East. We practice the same religion. And when it comes to it's a bit more complicated when it comes to religion, because most of the time religion does not determine ethnicity. Because mm-hmm. Christians are not ethnically Christian. There's no Christian mm-hmm. ethnicity. Muslims are not ethnically Muslim. There's no Muslim ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
But because those religions, for the most part, are universalizing religions that went and still do to this day actively try and convert people.
Mm-hmm.
They are religions where if you believe in it, you are that religion. It is very easy to convert to them. Christianity, you need to be baptized. Islam, you need to say the Shahada. But it's very easy to convert to these religions. You can practice them. Anyone can practice them from any culture, any like racial background, any linguistic background, so on and so forth. And it's been a religion that has historically been forced on people. But mm-hmm. Judaism, the reason why Judaism is an ethnicity and an ethno-religion more so than an ethnicity, something that is both an ethnicity and a religious identity, is because there is the ethnic aspect of Jews genetically are from this region. Jews genetically have ties to each other. If you look back thousands of years, you can see those ties. Jews have the same culture, so on and so forth. But there's also the religious aspect. So someone who converts to Judaism is not ethnically Jewish, but they are religiously Jewish. Someone born Jewish who considers themselves an atheist is ethnically Jewish, but not religiously Jewish.
Interesting, because I struggle. Like, some of my really good friends converted. How do I explain to someone that their soul was at Sinai? Like, it's very hard to explain that. And then I just feel like, I'm like, it's impossible to ever explain us because we're not explainable.
Yeah. And it's like, when you look at other religions, it's so easy to convert. People have been force converted. Like, people have forcibly been converted to Christianity and to Islam, for example. Judaism, you've never seen that.
Discourage.
There's no such thing. Exactly. We actively discourage conversion. And not only do we actively discourage conversion, but even when someone does go through the process of conversion, it takes years. It takes a lot of very intensive study, adopting traditions, adopting holidays, adopting culture, adopting language. Converting to Judaism is not just you say the Shahada or you're baptized and all of a sudden you are part of the religion. It is not you believe in the religion, therefore you are part of the religion. You have to be accepted. You have to be actively accepted by Jewish society to become Jewish. And it is a whole process. It is not just you do one thing and they're done. Like, of course, you do a bet din, mikvah, etc. You do become Jewish, but that's only after years and years and years of study and practice.
And I think the world is so sensitive to, like, other spiritual, like, you know, the Mabo case I remember studying in university. Mm-hmm. And Mabo came forward and said, you can't see my connection to the land. Like, the Aboriginals, they weren't, like, the Indigenous people of Australia, the First Nation people, they weren't builders. So they're basically coming before court and saying, we have a connection to this land. It's spiritual. You can't see it. Like, we are the Gadigal people of the Eora Nations. That's not where Mabo was from. But, like, for example, you can't see the buildings of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It's a spiritual connection they have to the land, and therefore we respect it. But I think for Jews, for some reason, because of anti-Semitism and whatever, it's very hard for people to respect our spiritual connection to the land, but yet we can be sensitively spiritual to other people. Like, why is it not, it's not legitimate for me to say my really good friend converted and therefore she has a soul and therefore she's just as legitimate to the lands of Israel as I am, because it's like, oh, well, her DNA and her,
yeah.
Like, with people are very quick to dismiss our religious beliefs, and it's, why is it less important than some Indigenous other people?
That's the thing for me. That's why, whilst I note that there is a lot of importance to the discussion of Judaism as an ethnic group, Jews as an ethnic group, Jews as an ethnic identity, and that connection to Israel, I think it's also, like, we can't minimize or dismiss the spiritual and religious connection we have to Israel, because that is just as much a part of our connection to Israel as, you know, all of the stuff that is a bit more concrete and provable. Just because other people don't believe in the same, like, whilst for me, when I talk to people about Jewish connection to Israel, I typically don't go with the religion spiritual argument, just because I find people say, I don't believe in that, therefore point is moot. But at the same time, I think as a people, we can't deny that connection. I think I think every Jew who has been to Israel knows the feeling of, like, the plane lands in Ben Gurion, you walk down, and, like, there is a feeling that comes over you of, like, being home, being where your soul needs to be. Like, I have, like, a very complicated relationship with religion and my belief, but even so, I've always, you know, every time I've been in Israel, I felt it. You get there, you land, you feel it. There is something in the air, I don't know what, but I feel like every Jew who has been to Israel knows what I'm talking about. You know what I mean? Like, that sense of, I don't know, that just, You just sort of feel at peace and you feel like you're where you're supposed to be. It's like, you know, when you walk down the street in Israel and everyone's talking Hebrew, everyone tells you Shabbat Shalom, Chag Sameach, whatever. Like, you don't get that anywhere else. Maybe in New York. But not other really. Than maybe New York, there's no way where you go and like the norm on a Friday afternoon is to say Shabbat Shalom. Everyone says it to everyone. You go to the supermarket, Shabbat Shalom. You go to the bank, Shabbat Shalom. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
there's no amount of jargon to explain that feeling.
Yeah. And it's like most people don't get it because there are 50-something Muslim countries and 50-something Christian countries. So in all of those countries, it is the norm to say Happy Eid, Eid Mubarak, or Merry Christmas. Like, that's the norm. So people, for the most part, are used to it. Jews, we only get that feeling in one place on earth, the size of New Jersey. There is a reason why Jews feel so connected. And it's not just because that is where our ancestors were. There is something indescribable about that connection that we have to our homeland. You know, like, I think it's very similar to the way Hindus look at India, right? It's a very similar concept because Hinduism is an ethno-religion founded in India. It's very, like, conceptually, it's very similar to Judaism. But I think it's a bit different with Judaism because we actually, like, there's more of a spiritual connection to the land itself. Like, there is more of, like, the Torah, like, a spiritual connection from the Torah, like, from the Torah to the land. And I don't know, I think whilst, yeah, it's important to acknowledge, like, the fact that Jews are an ethnic group and that we are more than just a religion, but we are also a religion, you know? And I think back in the day, you know, back when the Torah was written and all of the stories happened, I think back then we wouldn't have been considered a religion in the standard sense because, you know, we say Am Yisrael, like the nation of Israel. We don't say the religion of Jews. Like, Jews weren't identified as being a religious group back in those days. By modern definitions, people see Judaism and Jewish culture and heritage, and they call it a religion because they don't have a better word for it. But we are, it's more a tribal identity than it is a religion in the modern day sense of the word. Yes, like, we do practice a religion. It is, like, obviously Judaism is a religion, but when the Torah was written, when Judaism came to be, Hashem did not consider us a religion. Hashem considered us a nation. We were a tribe. We were a group of people. We weren't united based on the fact that we believed in Hashem. We were united on the fact that we were the people of Israel. We were the nation of Israel.
It's so true because you can be completely secular and be Jewish. Like,
yeah.
Being Jewish is so not defined by your
exactly
belief system. And that is so different to everyone else. Like, the second my hairdresser in New York, like, she doesn't consider herself Muslim. She grew up Muslim, but she's not Muslim anymore. But she says, like, my friend is completely secular, eats pork, but he's a Jew. I'm like, yeah, because we're not just a religion.
Yeah, exactly. Like, my dad 100% does not believe in God, does not believe in any of it, says the Torah is, you know, not true, whatever. He wears a Magen David. He has a Magen David, sacrilegious as it is, tattooed on his arm. He is, like, the proudest Jew there is. But he doesn't believe in the religion. And people get so confused when I say that my dad's an atheist because they're like, isn't your dad Jewish? Yeah, he is. But he's also an atheist. You can be both. It's not, like, the thing about Christianity and Islam, for example, they are all both completely based on faith. If you believe, you are. If you do not believe, you are not. People say, like, I'm an ex-Catholic or I'm an ex-Muslim when they're talking about, like, going from being either religion to being an atheist. They don't say that they are a Muslim atheist or a Catholic atheist.
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah, but Jews, there are so many Jewish atheists.
So many.
So many. This is just a point that I was thinking about when it comes to the way we talk about Israel and Palestine in the West nowadays. It is very much sort of through this sort of lens of white progressivism, in the sense that I find that white leftists and progressives they project their own guilt onto the Middle East.
Totally.
It's this idea of the conflict is colonizer versus colonized. The Jews colonized Palestine. The white European Jews colonized the brown Palestinians, despite the fact that many Palestinians are pale with light hair and light eyes.
Gigi Hadid.
Bella Hadid, both of them. Like, I had two friends that were Palestinian. I don't talk to either of them anymore post October 7th, but both of them had very similar coloring to me. Pale, dark eyes, dark hair, but like fair. And like, you know, the very typical Middle Eastern features, the nose, the facial structure, etc. But like this idea of Israel is Palestinian land that was colonized by the Jews is just people in the West projecting their own guilt over the crimes of their ancestors onto a conflict thousands of kilometers away that they have no connection or understanding of. It is that simple. You know, when, like, it's also, you hear, like, when it comes to the way people talk about Israel and the way people talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it very much is dependent on their political affiliation. You'll hear people on the left speak about Israel and Palestine in one way, and then you'll hear people on the right speak about it a different way. It is solely, the way people speak about the conflict is not based on what is true. It is based on what their belief aligns with. And I think that's why people get so many misconceptions in their head about Israel, because the way they consume content and media, especially nowadays, where everyone's listening to podcasts and everyone is on Instagram and TikTok and looking at all of these, you know, social media platforms, is everyone gets whatever their algorithm has sort of allocated to them, whatever their algorithm thinks fits what they would be interested in best. And as a result, we aren't allowed to define our own conflict in our own words. Everyone defines our connection to Israel for us. Everyone defines the conflict for us. They call it this or that. Some people say it's war. Some people say it's genocide. Let us define it. We're the ones going through it. We're the ones experiencing it. This is our homeland. This is our country. We should be the ones, you know, sort of establishing the narrative on what this is and on what the Jewish connection to Israel is. And I think the worst thing, honestly, the worst thing for me, at least, are the anti-Zionist Jews. I think a lot of people strengthen their connection with Israel when they learn about the Holocaust, but I think some people detach themselves from Israel when they learn about the Holocaust. I think it's sort of a bit of a, like, an intergenerational trauma response, if that makes sense. Like, I think some people latch onto Israel when they know more about the Holocaust because, oh, we need the protection, we need our homeland. But some people detach themselves from Israel because it's easier to demonize Israel and say, but the Jews didn't do this, the Jews shouldn't be to blame, blah, 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 than it is to say this is our homeland. Like, it is easier to sort of disconnect yourself from it so that you can, you know, project blame onto it than it is to just identify with it. And I think when it comes to the way we talk about Israel and Gaza and Palestine and whatever, like, we let people define that for us, which we shouldn't be, because it's something that we should be defining for ourselves. We should be the ones controlling the narrative on why we're connected to Israel, what Israel is, how Israel is the home of the Jewish people. And I think there are so many misconceptions about it. And I think part of that is because people think that with 5 minutes of education, they can define it perfectly, as though they know which side is Gaza and which side is the West Bank. The way we talk about Israel I think Jews need to really control the narrative on that.
And I think that's why we're here. I think this is only the beginning. Like, if you're listening to this podcast right now and thinking, okay, that's all I need to know, it's not true.
Oh, there is. That's the thing. When it comes to geopolitical conflicts, I would argue that this is the most complicated one out there, at least in the modern day. There is so much to know and so much to learn and so much to understand. I don't know enough about it. People will often ask me things and I'll say, look, this is what I've learned. This is what I know, but I don't know enough. And I feel like I know a decent bit, you know?
You know a lot, Emily.
But, like, there's no such thing as knowing enough. because there is so much to understand and so much to learn.
How do we learn more?
I think the most important thing you can do is just educate yourself, but from different perspectives. Like, I have always kept an open mind to like seeing perspectives that don't align with mine about Israel, because I just, part of it is also I want to know how other people perceive Israel. Like whether it's positive or negative, doesn't matter. But I want to see how other people perceive Israel and, you know, the wider conflict and everything. And I think when we allow ourselves to learn from more sources than one, it allows for a broader understanding and it allows for a more, like, I guess, a bit of a deeper understanding.
And Emily, such an honor to have you. We need you to come back. We need to do part two because there's so much that I feel like we didn't yet cover.
I might be in Israel at the end of the year.
I'll see you there.
Yeah.
You're incredible. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You're unbelievable. Listen to this podcast twice. Educate yourself because we're going to need it. We need all the education that we can possibly get. And if you're feeling out there and you're feeling alone, just know that we're amazing. Jewish people, we're an incredible...
I'm Yisrael Chai.
We're an incredible phenomenon. And never, even though we do need to explain ourselves, just know that your mere existence is of value. And I think with that, it's a wrap.
Yeah.
I'm Yisrael Chai.